The mighty steam locomotives that conquered the continent are history. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Renowned photographer and essayist David Plowden was a young man, just beginning his career when the last steam engines were leaving the tracks. He set off on a feverish quest to photograph the remaining engines before they disappeared forever. His latest book, Requiem for Steam, The Railroad Photographs of David Plowden, features some of those pictures. Today we'll talk about the place those massive machines hold in our history and in our hearts. And we'll also talk about his personal love affair with the locomotive. You're welcome to join our conversation at 866-780-9100. You can also send us email at talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Now the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. Photographer and essayist David Plowden was just beginning his career when the last steam engines were being replaced by diesel engines. At the 11th hour, he made it his mission to photograph as many of the steam engines as he could before they disappeared forever. Many of those stunning photographs are in his new book, Requiem for Steam, The Railroad Photographs of David Plowden. And David Plowden is here with me today. Thank you so much for coming to the studio, David.
It's nice to be here. Thank you for asking me.
You grew up in New York City and also in Vermont. When did you first fall in love with steam engines?
I think I fell in love with the steam engine when I first saw it out of a train window in a on a trip to South Carolina. And I remember waking up and seeing engines in the yards outside of Washington. But I really don't remember when I first fell in love with it because it's always been so much of a part of my life.
And when you were a child, you rode trains all the time.
All the time. All the time. And I knew the crews, particularly in Vermont, and I knew the crews on the trains, and I made friends with them. And so they let me ride the engines, the baggage cars. And I spent a lot of time down at the station watching trains. And I learned a lot about the railroads. And I would, you know, be invited into the ticket office, and the operator, who was my friend at the, in the third trick, second trick, would let me listen on the radio. The telephone, the dispatcher's line, and so I would listen to all the trains. Everything was going on the railroad. I could tell exactly when the trains were coming. He also taught me how to use the telegraph key. I never became what they call a lightning slinger. But I did, at one point in my life, know the Morse code, and he let me practice with this. And, of course, I knew when all the trains were going to be there, and I would walk up to where the southbound trains waited for the northbound trains at the end of double track at my little village of Putney, Vermont. And I'd walk up to the engine, and I'd walk around and look up at the engine, walk back and forth in front of it, and I'd hope the engineer would get the point that I really would like to be invited into the cab. Most of them did. So they threw down a wad of cotton waste, and I would climb up into the cab when I was 12, 11. And this extraordinary space where these two men controlled this remarkably powerful machine, and, of course, it opened the firebox door and let me look into this thing, which is sort of like looking into a volcano. And, you know, for years and years, I went to the railroad, and in a sense, the railroad really brought me up. And there were two wonderful people that I knew on a railroad called the Rutland Railroad, which ran from Bellows Falls up, well, it ran all the way up to the end of the border next to, on the way to Montreal. But on these trains, I got to know these crews so well that when we'd get to Rutland, one of them would say, "Now, listen, you got out the other side of the train. Quick, hurry up. Train manager's not looking, but Bill Cannon, he's waiting for you in the cab." And so I would ride the cab of this engine from Bellows Falls down, from Rutland to Bellows Falls. And these were ancient engines.
Wow.
And they were always trying to make up time. They never could. And the track was more like a dirt road than a railroad line. And I was absolutely terrifying, but exhilarating, as holding on for my dear life when this little engine buckled and bounced and roared across Vermont. What an experience for a young kid.
Yeah.
And I got to know railroad people all over and out of New York when I got older, and I rode trains. I hate flying. I still ride the trains, and it's not the same today as it used to be.
Well, they don't let you ride up in the cab, probably,
no.
For one thing.
No. Things are a little tougher.
Right. When did you get your first camera?
Well, when I was about 11, I remember using my mother's box brownie, a little red box brownie camera, went down to the station one day to take a picture of the 420, which is, that's when it arrived at the station. And I stood on the platform and I held my mother's camera, and this train comes whistling and round the corner, and this big engine with piles of smoke pouring out of it. I got buck fever. I started to shake. I was so excited. So I handed the camera to my mother and I said, "Here, you take it." So about a week or two later, I was back on the platform and held my ground and got my first photograph, and it was 1943.
So the very first picture you ever took was of a steam engine.
Yes. And for the next 15 years, I really took nothing but pictures of railroads. I had no idea of being a photographer. I was going to be a railroad man. And so when I went to school, I went to college, I went to Yale, and I studied economics so that I could become a railroad executive. But this was a terrible mistake, because it really wasn't the business end of railroading that interests me. It was the romance.
Right.
And when I was on the Great Northern, I went to the Great Northern in Wilmore, Minnesota, and two things happened. One, I fell in love with the Middle West, and they had it was the last place on the Great Northern where they had any steam locomotives. So I was paid, this is sort of immoral, to ride locomotives, which I did, until I was promoted. And when I was promoted away from the engines. And everybody said, "Oh, you're on the way to the general office. Now, this is what we want for you." And I was horrified. So I quit.
Yeah, I think you had an experience a lot of people had when they fall in love with something and they start working their way up the ladder and find that the people at the top of the ladder don't get to get their hands dirty.
I know. And I wanted to get my hands dirty. I wanted to stay with the trains that I love so much. And I really, it was a fascinating experience. It was my first real experience with the Middle West, with the Dakotas. I never got over that. In fact, I'm working on a book about that now. But when I quit the railroad, what am I going to do? So I finally went to work. Well, I went to work for two travel agencies, and just to keep busy. I finally knew a photographer, didn't know him, knew of him, a man named Winston Link, who I'm sure is very familiar to anybody who knows railroad photography. So I brazenly called him up. I said, "Could I come and see you?" Luckily, he needed someone to work for him. And that was in the fall of 1958. And that's where my photographic career really began. I worked for Link, and then he had the Norfolk and Western Railway sort of in his pocket. It was his own. That was his turf. And he did phenomenal photographs of trains at night and with flash bulbs. Lighting up the whole night.
Mm-hmm.
I took photographs in the day, very different. So I thought, this is the 11th hour for the steam engine. I would really like somehow to document these in my own way. So remembering the steam engines in Vermont, remembering the whistles of the Central Vermont, owned by the Canadian National, realizing the Canadian Pacific had the largest concentration of steam engines in Canada and the United States, I went to them. I asked them. I wrote brazenly again, the public relations manager. And so in the summer of 59, I went to the Canadian Pacific. After that, I took a lot of pictures. And after that, I went to study with Minor White.
So when you were at the Canadian Pacific, when you wrote that brazen letter, you were given pretty much free run of the whole...
Yes.
All of the trains.
I was. I was amazed. I just thought, this is another guy who wants to photograph, and he'd probably say no. But I wrote a letter that said, sort of emphasizing the importance of the railroads and the steam locomotive to the history of both our countries and how important it was, because the steam engine did bring about the Industrial Revolution. But it struck a chord with him, and he said, come to Montreal. So I came to Montreal, and I talked to him about this, and he – there was no question in his mind. He said, okay, what can I do for you, essentially? So he gave me a ticket to heaven, as I put it. He gave me permission to go anywhere on the Atlantic Division, which is Atlantic region, which is where they were running the engines, the roundhouses, ride the freight trains, ride the locomotives, anything I wanted. And so, I mean, I spent the summer, and I did indeed photograph to my heart's content, road trains back, engines back and forth on different lines.
What were you going to do with those photographs?
I was going to make a book.
Okay.
I didn't have a publisher, but I was determined that I was going to document these things and I was going to make a book. From the very beginning, I was determined to make books, and I've made quite a few books since then. And I may have even told Mr. Wallace this, because that was my whole idea. And my whole idea also, because there were so few engines, was not to photograph them as individuals. This engine, you know, this is the G3 class Pacific or whatever. That didn't interest me. The whole idea was to get a sense of locomotiveness, what these engines really, what they really were like as a creature, as a machine. And, you know, there were never more than a dozen at the time anyplace. And I decided the best thing to do was also to get them in the roundhouse and in the engine terminals, where you could get very intimate with them. And if you walked through the roundhouse, you know, they were almost breathing. So you sense the term iron horse. And I loved it in there. And I used to spend hours photographing in the roundhouse. And also, well, you know, the steam engine was a very labor-intensive machine. And it took an awful lot of people to keep it going. And these were all fascinating people. And I did an enormous number of these people working on the engines. And to me, that's what I found that was the most interesting part of it. Not necessarily just steaming down the main line, you know, but being very close in touch with this intriguing machine and the people who worked on it.
Well, we will talk more about those pictures you took and the experiences you had riding the rails in a few minutes. My guest is David Plowden. We're talking today about his book, Requiem for Steam, The Railroad Photographs of David Plowden.
To the south built by the shore. She's mighty tall and handsome. She's known quite well by all. She's the combination on the Wabash cannonball. She came down from Birmingham one cold December day. As she rolled into the station, you could hear all the people say, there's a girl from Tennessee, she's long and she's tall.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe, and my guest today is David Plowden. He's a renowned photographer and essayist. We're talking about his latest book, Requiem for Steam, The Railroad Photographs of David Plowden. And we're talking about steam engines and his personal love affair with them and the experiences that he had taking pictures and riding the rails. And we'd love to hear about your memories as well. I know that many of you also have shared this love affair with steam engines. You can join our conversation by giving us a call at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send us email at talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. So, David, before the break, we were talking about the experience that you had in Canada on the Canadian Pacific Railroad, and you had this amazing free pass to ride any of the trains that you wanted, to take any of the pictures that you wanted. And then you submitted some of those pictures to Minor White, who was one of the most influential photographers of the 20th century, in hopes of getting into his workshop. What was his response when he looked at your pictures?
Well, I showed him these photographs, and, you know, there were some very serious photographers in the room. And this, you know, I went with photographs of locomotives, engines. And when I got into his place, I thought, I don't really belong here. You know, these are just pictures of trains, and these people took themselves very seriously, and they were very fine photographers, and I felt very out of place. But Miner took the pictures, and he went through them. It may have been 15, 20, 25 photographs, all of locomotives. And he put them in front of himself and looked at them, and he went through them all and said nothing. And my heart sank. I said, why am I here? So then he went through them again, very quietly. And meanwhile, three or four other people had come around to watch Miner look at these photographs. And I began to feel, please, where's the door? Let me get out of here. I don't belong here. Miner was very serious, and he finally put all the pictures down, and he turned and looked at me, and he said, you're a poet. I'll take you. And I thought to myself, what? No one had ever thought, I never thought of myself as a poet. I thought of myself as a young person who adored locomotives and went out to photograph them. So, to my amazement, Miner took me on in a very, very elite workshop. And I also studied with Nathan Lyons, who was a marvelous photographer. And Miner decided that he was going to teach us from the ground up how to make photographs. And his idea of a photographer, I thought, was wonderful. He said, photographer is somebody who has his feet on the ground and his head in the clouds. He put us through the zone system, all kinds of technical things. And then he would go in, we'd all go in the field, the four of us and Miner. And every day we went into the field to one place so we could photograph. And he taught us how to see things. And Nathan taught us how to photograph things that were unphotographable, emotions. Now, go photograph silence. Go photograph happiness. Go photograph sadness. And between the two of them, I learned an enormous amount. But every fourth day was my turn to choose a place to go and photograph. And guess what?
I'll bet you wanted to take pictures of trains.
That's right. We went to railroad yards and stations, and we went to photograph the underpinnings of bridges. And all of the rest of them sort of sighed and said, oh, why are we doing this? And Miner was nice. He seemed very nice. He said, now look. David goes with us to where we want to go. This is his day. We're going to go to the railroad yards with him. Well, anyway, he knew very much that he knew that my love of the railroad was very, very compelling. And finally, I think I began to feel the fact that the engines were dying. They were going to go. And I really didn't want to stay any longer. I felt I had to get out there and photograph those engines. And Miner must have realized this because he said, go do your damned engines and get them out of your system. Otherwise, you'll never do anything else. And I thought he was angry. I thought he was frustrated. But you know, he wasn't. He really understood how important the locomotives and the engines were to me. So I did. I left.
And you left in the dead of winter.
That's right. In the dead of winter, it was still snowing when I left Rochester. It snows a great deal up there. I followed the snowplows out of town, and I went to Montreal again to see Mr. Wallace. And I spent 2 weeks in Montreal in the dead of winter. It was absolutely freezing cold, which was wonderful because, of course, you had when cold, you had all this wonderful steam coming out of the engines. And it made it feel much more alive than in the hot summer. And so I spent 2 weeks in Montreal, and then the deals began to come. And so then I moved down east to where I'd been in the summer and photographed them. And they were virtually all gone, all except for one, a little train called the Scoot, which ran from Brownville Junction over the border to Megantic, Quebec. And it was the last regularly scheduled train in the United States, except for the Silverton on the narrow gauge.
In Colorado.
In Colorado.
Which is still running.
Which is still running.
Durango to
Silverton. And it was running when I was doing this. Not in the winter. But this was the last regularly scheduled train. So I wrote it. And I rode the engine over from Brownville Junction to Bagatic on the 28th of March. And then I was in the cab coming back on the 29th of March. And I told the engineer and fireman when I went over this bridge, the ship pond, what's it called, the ship pond? Let's call it the Onawa Viaduct. And I'd seen a picture of it. And I said to the crew, I'd love to get a picture of that. So when we got to Onawa, they cut the engine off and ran me across the bridge and left me on the other side. And I said, you're going to have to catch us when we're going by because we're going up grade. So here I was, left on the other side, and they backed the train off. And then I heard them whistle off and on at once, and I got everything ready. I had pointed out exactly where I should find the spot to photograph the engine. And I made sure that I fired two exposures, because you never wanted to use the first two exposures. So I waited until I had one place in mind where I could get one shot and one that I really wanted. So that was going to be the fourth exposure. And I had an old Rolleiflex, which I adored. And as the train came, I fired it once. And then as it came right where I wanted to fire it, for some reason, the smoke lifted up so that the mountain behind the engine is now framed by the smoke. Serendipity, absolutely, had nothing to do with it. And the train came, the engine came by, and I remember throwing the camera over my back and getting right up next to the engine. So I'd caught engines before when I worked on the Great Northern, but I'd had an accident when my arm had been pulled out of joint.
And when you're talking about catching an engine,
you're going to swing yourself up, right? Swing myself up into the cab. And I thought to myself, don't think about that, Plowden, just do it.
Because you had dislocated your shoulder.
I dislocated my shoulder on the Great Northern getting onto a train that was going too fast. And the brakeman said, well, you better get on because there's not going to be another train around here until Monday. And it was Friday, and it was a dead of winter in South Dakota. So I thought I'd better catch the train. But anyway, so I got the picture. And the chief dispatcher, who had been my friend, had said to me, sent a message to the train just as it came over the border. They take orders and water at a place called Jackman. And there's a little note for me that said, train number 517, the Scoot going west, will have diesel tomorrow.
So that was the very last run of the Scoot.
It turned out that they ran it once more because they had to get the engine from Brownville Junction to Montreal so it could be scrapped. So it ran once more on the 4th of April. But this was the first time, the next day was the first time that that train had ever had a diesel. And to me, when I got to Brownville Junction and I sat in the cab of that engine until I watched the steam gauge drop to zero, to me that was the end. The whole thing stopped there because, to me, it was the continuity had been broken.
Right. Well, and even you, when you left Brownville Junction, you heard a story on the radio that said as much.
Well, they said, they said that the Grand Trunk, there'd been an engine, a passenger train on the Grand Trunk, which had run the 27th. And I said to myself, and what about today, the Scoot? Because the Grand Trunk ran a special. They had been running steam engines on passenger trains with a special run. And this was this train was a real working train. And as far as I'm concerned, the era ended there.
So you were there.
I was there, absolutely. And I will never forget it.
So I understand that you love locomotives and you love the steam engines, but why was that such a difficult thing for you to see steam go away?
Well, I suppose, in the first place, the steam engine is probably the most compelling machine, and the diesels just didn't look interesting to me. And I think what also, it set in motion a whole career of photographing things that were disappearing. And I didn't realize it at the time. I was just saying goodbye to the steam engine, which was it was such a compelling thing. It really was.
Well, when you write about them, you write about them as if they're animals, not as if they're machines.
You're right. I really do. And they really were living creatures. You felt so. And I think an awful lot of people have felt the same way. And I don't think any other piece of machinery that I can think of was that interesting. Moreover, no other piece of machinery was so accessible. I mean, you could see it running across the landscape almost anywhere in the Western world and almost anywhere in the world. And it would be, you could go down to the foot of Main Street and there it would be. You could go to the station and there it would be. And there's, you know, you can't get out to airplanes very easily. I don't find the automobile very interesting. So many of the accomplishments of today are far away, like you sort of see the contrails in the sky, right? And so many of the machines are covered up, and so many of the accomplishments are cerebral. So you really don't, you can't really photograph them. They're not visual. But the locomotive was completely accessible for everybody to wander, just like a bridge. And you could look at it and understand. I'm not a bridge engineer, but I did a book on bridges. And you could look at a bridge and understand what held it up. You could go and look at the steam locomotive and look at all those connecting rods and the wheels and understand what made it work. And then you could feel the heat. You knew that this was a machine that worked, and you could feel it and you could see it. And the diesel, everything's covered up.
Yeah.
And there has none of the drama. I don't know whether I'm answering your question or not, but I think what happened was when the steam engine went, I suddenly looked around and realized that so many other things were going. I mean, after the Second World War, we changed profoundly. And, the interstate highway came shortly thereafter. Television, now the internet and all of that, all of the incredible scientific things discoveries, and the automobile. People don't go to the stations anymore. There are very few trains. And I realized, I have to somehow or other, it was sort of a mission for me to photograph the things that were disappearing. Main Street, all right? It's almost just vanished. The little stores. Even the steel industry. I went and did a book on the steel industry because I knew that that was changing. And so I always... Oh, it's such an awful expression. I said it once, I'll say it again. I was always one step ahead of the wrecking ball. And my life has been spent that way, trying to capture these things on film so there'll be a record of them 100 years from now with the world. I mean, even in my lifetime, I've seen such profound changes since the steam locomotive that I don't recognize it as the world I knew when I grew up. I'm trying to photograph it, document it.
After the run of the Scoot, after that final steam engine run, you had all of these pictures. What was your next step? What did you do?
Well, my next step was to see if I could get someone to publish a book. And it took a while. I also went around to a lot of different places to see if people were interested in perhaps commissioning me to go out and photograph railroad stations, to go out and photograph all of the railroad ferries that used back and forth in New York Harbor, which they did. And then I suddenly realized, oh, my Lord, the steamboats are going. So I got people to go out and let me photograph those. And then the bridges, the old iron bridges. Well, I even got the Guggenheim Foundation to sponsor a project to photograph the old bridges that we would lose. The Smithsonian picked up on that. So this all began to amount into a mass of photographs, and I always felt that these photographs were valuable, not because I took them, but because they were pictures of things that were very important to American culture and engineering history, our history. And so... Actually, the Beinecke Library at Yale is in the process of acquiring my collection because they feel they'd like to have the photographs that I took so that people 50 and 100 years from now could look at them and be able to study an America that doesn't exist anymore.
Well, and the steam engine is a perfect example of that. And even now you can see steam engines. You can ride on steam-powered trains. But I was in Greenfield Village in Dearborn, Michigan, and they're restoring one of the giant locomotives. And, you know, the experience of riding on one of these domesticated little trains is so different from standing next to one of these giant locomotives. Yes. It's impossible to really conceive what it was like to see these monsters.
I know. And even the ones that have been preserved in museums, there's no steam.
Yeah.
And there's nothing deader than a piece of machinery that was hot and vibrant when it's dead. But there are people who have restored engines. I mean, who have spent their lives, volunteers who are restoring locomotives to run. And some of the railroads, including the Canadian Pacific, has actually restored one of their own locomotives to run. Well, as sort of ambassadors.
Yeah. And we'll talk more about that passion for steam in a moment. My guest is David Plowden. His latest book is Requiem for Steam, The Railroad Photographs of David Plowden. He'll be appearing at Prairie Lights Bookstore in Iowa City tonight at 6 o'clock.
Riding on the city of New Orleans, Illinois Central, Monday morning rail.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe, and my guest today is photographer and essayist David Plowden. We're talking about his latest book, Requiem for Steam, The Railroad Photographs of David Plowden. David is here as a guest of Humanities Iowa, part of their Voices of From the Prairie annual Iowa Writers Celebration, and he will be at Prairie Lights Bookstore tonight in Iowa City at 6 o'clock, and then he'll be in Council Bluffs tomorrow at the Public Library from 6 to 8 p.m., and then the next day in Sioux City at Western Iowa Tech Community College at 6:30 p.m. If you'd like to join our conversation about steam engines and railroads, you can give us a call at 866-780-9100. You can also tweet us at IPR Talk, or you can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And Doug is on the line from Osage. Hello, Doug.
Hello, Charity.
Hi.
Yeah, I just got a question. He's doing a book on steam engines for the his locomotives, but has he considered doing a photography book and like essays and stuff as far as steam engines concerning the industrial and agricultural usage of steam?
Well, a lot of...
And I'll take my answer off of here.
Okay, thanks a lot. Thanks a lot for your call, Doug. Well, in your book, I mean, there are many, many photographs, and you have a collection of photographs of the rain, the rail tracks and the grain elevators in these small towns in Iowa. And, of course, the steam engines were so important to the agricultural industry.
Well, they were, and there were, of course, there were also those wonderful steam traction engines that were used before the diesel tractors and before the combines of today. I mean, you had these wonderful threshing machines, and they were steam engines, and I guess there's steam engine meat still going on. Fascinating and beautiful. But when you think about it, without the railroad, there would not have been a way to get the grain to market. And if you look today, I don't have to tell you this, along the railroad tracks, anywhere, almost anywhere out here in this wonderful heartland, there are grain elevators. And almost always those grain elevators were built beside a railroad track. So the railroads had a very important role in developing this country.
Right, absolutely. In Iowa, there are many, many towns who would not exist if it wasn't for the railroads.
Absolutely right, and all over. I mean, it was said, you know, that a farmer could leave his farm in the morning, having done his chores, drive into town, do everything he had to do in town, and drive back and get back for the evening chores if it weren't more than 6 miles away. And if you look at the map of this country, you'll find that almost everywhere out here that's a town every 6 miles, no matter in every direction. And almost all of those towns were built by the railroads. And today, I mean, they've abandoned thousands upon thousands of miles of railroad track, particularly on the small little branch lines that served the grain elevators. But the railroads are still here. And the grain elevators are still here. And they are indeed the icon, I think, of this great country out here.
Well, and this is going to sound silly to you, I'm sure, but before reading your book, it had never occurred to me that the term jerkwater town comes from the steam engine.
Absolutely. It was a town where there was a water pug. The steam engine really, you could say it was an awful nuisance because every 25 miles or so, they had to have a water plug to fill it up because it needs water, obviously, to create steam. You boil it. And yes, a jerkwater town is exactly that. It might have just been a water plug and a few stores. And this term comes absolutely from the railroads.
So and it was a town that sprang up strictly because of that little water
strictly
tower.
Strictly because of that water tower. And the jerkwater towns may still be there, but the water plug isn't there anymore. They're gone.
Well, we have here in Iowa, of course, we have the Scenic Valley Railroad in Boone.
Yes.
Where you can still ride behind a steam engine and experience a little bit of what that was like. And I recently moved back from Michigan. I mentioned Greenfield Village, where you can ride behind a steam engine. We talked earlier about that steam engine train that runs from Durango, Colorado, up the mountain to Silverton. So people have those experiences. And what I find is very interesting about it is how that resonates, especially with little boys, so much. I often wonder, what is it about steam engines that just speaks to little boys? And anybody who has a little boy has probably seen Thomas the Tank Engine cartoons. I mean, there are so many steam engine toys. Why do you think that still resonates?
It's fascinating. You know, well, maybe all of us who love steam engines never grew up still remember our childhood, but I think kids today, I mean, there's something about the idea of the locomotive, the idea of this machine that made the noise, this machine that where, again, you could, as a little child, you could see how it worked. And I think that, even in toys, I mean, these little engines, you could see them, you could sort of get, and they also have a personality, which is very much the way locomotives were. And I know for one that I loved the big engines, but I always had little engines. And I think children, you can't fool them. They know something that's interesting. They know something that's fun. And I'm not so sure that they have – I don't know, because my kids are all grown up. But I don't know that any other machine captivated the imagination of a child, and even a picture of it. You look at a photograph or a painting of it or a toy, it's more interesting looking somehow than a diesel. Or, I mean, you know, lots of people are interested in airplanes and cars, but to me, I think there's nothing as interesting as that little toy train, engine, steam engine. And, you know, and choo-choo. I mean, you know, I mean, children talk about choo-choos. And when you see a train advertised today or toys advertised, they're always going back to the locomotive. And they go usually way back to engines that were built, that designed in the 19th century. Fascinating, isn't it?
It is. It's very interesting. Kim is on the line at 866-780-9100 from Webb. Hello, Kim.
Yes, thank you. I just wanted to relate three quick stories about my experience with steam engines. I grew up in this town of 200 people, and we had the Milwaukee Road going through it. And when I was in grade school, I remember several times that while the train was switching, the big steam engine was switching, many times the locomotives was right next to the schoolyard, and a group of us boys would absolutely pelt it with snowballs while it was stopped. And then the train would release that side lateral steam out that would shoot out 30, 40 feet and absolutely soak us, and we loved it.
In the middle of winter.
Oh, yeah, in the middle of winter, sure.
Your mothers must have loved that.
That sounds like an awful lot of fun. I wish I'd been to school next to the tracks.
Well, we were on recess or, you know, noon hour or something like that. another story I remember, we would put pennies on the track, of course, like everybody does. But one time, and I was young, I mean, I was like in fourth grade, put maybe a one-inch by four-inch by two-inch piece of metal on the track, thinking it might smash it. And then it dawned on me when I was in class, and again, I was in third or fourth or fifth grade, that I might derail the train, and I was paranoid all afternoon.
What happened?
Nothing. Absolutely nothing. But I was sure scared.
Well, you were right to be scared.
Yeah.
And the last thing is, I am right now back in this town. I grew up here, and then I went away to college, and I've been gone for 40 years, 45 years. But they have removed those tracks. And right now I'm back here, as I do every fall, to help my brother harvest the corn, and I'm driving a tractor currently back and forth from the combine, and they've removed the track, but still I cross it every day 10 times. I can't help but look at where the old railroad grade went through, look both ways for trains.
Well,
Kim, thanks so much for your call. David, what were you going to say?
I was going to say, man after my own heart. Every time I cross a railroad crossing or a place where a train had been, I listen and hope in my mind's ear can hear a train whistle. Nothing as haunting as a train whistle.
John is on the line in Belmont. Hello, John.
Hello.
Hi, what would you like to talk about?
Well, we have a road locomotive, and it is a locomotive patterned after a train engine that is on truck tires, and we run it up and down the road.
So you have basically a railroad engine that runs on tires that you've built this?
Pardon?
You built this?
We bought it, broke down from a place in Kansas, and rebuilt it, and we run it around here in parades. And we fire it with coal, and it runs with three whistles. And the best time to run it is in the wintertime when you can see the steam.
Oh, yes.
There is a parade in Belmont on the Friday after Thanksgiving that we've run it in the last couple times, and we've had it at a steam show here in Belmont. And I don't know where you are from, but if you would like to come, we will fire it the Friday after Thanksgiving in Belmont.
Right.
Well, thank you very much.
Thanks so much, John. Well, and that just speaks to what we were talking about earlier, David, that there is something about these engines that still fascinates and attracts people.
It still fascinates everybody. And there are people like this man who just called who are restoring engines. And there are many, many of them. Whole societies that go back and then they actually volunteers that rebuild locomotives to run.
It is amazing because if you think about other kinds of obsolete technology, you don't see as many people completely and utterly devoted to other kinds of, I mean, you don't see people restoring manual typewriters and having shows and taking them out in parades.
That's actually true. There you are talking about that compelling machine that we don't want to. We really don't want it to die, and so many of us hold on to it. I do it through photographs. These other people do it through restoring them. It has a hold on the imagination that no other machine had, I think. And I think just listening to these people who call in and listening to other people who spend their lives, it really has had a place in the whole culture of this country. No other machine has, as far as I'm concerned.
Ron is on the line in the Quad Cities, and he has, I think, another machine that he wants to talk about. Hi, Ron.
Hi, Charity. And Mr. Plowden has tried to explain to you what it is about that steam engine and little boys. It is, in fact, as Mr. Plowden says, that machine is like an animal. It does breathe. And it does magical things. And I'm about his age, and I wanted to speak with him about steam and riverboats here in the Quad Cities, the Mississippi River, the Ohio. All of those were the interstates prior to the railroads, 30 years prior to the first steam railroad. Steamboats were those vehicles that brought everything in the agricultural world and the industrial world to the rest of us. Those engines and steamboats started those three decades earlier and died perhaps a decade prior to the locomotive. However, when that steam disappeared, the boats remained, and those boats are still alive with the same voices that he speaks of poetically with regard to his locomotives.
And you did go out, and you also photographed steamboats as well.
Yes, I did. I did. My first book was called Farewell to Steam, and it was partial. It was half locomotives and half steamships, steamboats, not steamships, steamboats. And I did a lot of work. I did the Lone Star up here, which used to be in Davenport, and I did the Delta Queen. I did a lot of the tugs, and then I did a book a few years ago on the Great Lakes steamboats, which is called End of an Era, and that indeed was the end of the era of steamboats, because they used steam far, far longer on the Great Lakes. I mean, salt water is kinder to metal than salt. And also they got a nice long rest in the winter when their lakes froze up so they could repair them. And so steamboats lasted on the Great Lakes. As you know, they still have some operating on the Great Lakes. And their steamboats lasted a great deal longer than the steam engine on the railroads. And they were fascinating. But one of the things, I guess, is that you couldn't see the engine on the stern wheelers out here on the river. Yes, you could. You could actually see the pistons and the pitons turning the wheels. And I remember the last one I saw was the Delta Queen in the last year that it operated. And it was, you could really get the sense of the power of the engine by looking at the stern wheel. And I'm afraid we've lost a great deal of that. Now they're gone. The Delta Queen's gone.
We have just a moment left. When people look at these pictures of steam engines, of the old depots, of the roundhouses, of all of the things that you've documented here, what do you want them to see?
I want them to see something that's interesting. You know, even if they never saw a steam locomotive, I'm hoping that the photograph is compelling enough for them to look at it and say, what a wonderful-looking thing this was. How exciting. How beautiful the stations were, you know. Even if you've never been inside a station, take time to look at what they really, the spaces looked like, and try to go on the platform with the steam coming out of the cars and try to sort of think about what it might have been like to have been there yourself. And I hope that people will enjoy them. I hope they will see the beauty in these places. I hope they will, you know, catch their breath for a minute. Take the time.
David, thank you so much for your time today. David Plowden's latest collection is called Requiem for Steam, the Railroad Photographs of David Plowden. Talk of Iowa is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. Check it, check it, check it, check it, check it, check it. All aboard.